There's a quote that says, "Live then and be happy, beloved children of my heart." It's from a novel. And never forget that until the day when God will deign to reveal the future to man, all human wisdom is contained in these two words: wait and hope. Your friend, Edmond Dantes, Count of Monte Cristo. You better have read that book before. You're familiar with that story. As gigantic of a book as that is. This quote, again, it comes from Alexander Dumas's The Count of Monte Cristo, where in a quest for vengeance against those who framed him and betrayed him, Edmond Dantes escapes a life sentence in the worst prison in the land. He finds an enormous treasure on an island. He reinvents himself, and he starts executing this elaborate plan of vengeance against the people who did him wrong. And in the end, he finally renounces his quest for vengeance, writing in this letter saying that justice is really in the hands of God, not people, not humans. And everything we can know as humans in our sufferings, betrayals, and hardships in this fallen world, everything that we can know is contained in the words, wait and hope, wait and hope. So brothers and sisters, you and I don't have to live the kind of full and vengeance-fueled life that Edmond Dantes did before we arrive at this conclusion. His words are true here, and they point to the truth of the words that we hear from Paul in Romans 8. As he writes to a church, as he writes to people who live in the same kind of world that Alexander Dumas writes about in The Count of Monte Cristo, a world that's filled with suffering and pain and injustice and betrayal and sickness and death and the burning desire, yet helplessness, the weakness to do something about all of these broken realities. A world, an entire created order that is plagued by sin. You feel this, right? You know what living in this kind of world is like, right? These things are a part of your everyday reality, are they not? Maybe it's disease ravaging your body, crippling weakness and dysfunction, loss, maybe of a loved one, a betrayal from someone close, calamities and natural disasters, injustices of all sorts. Or even like we just turned on the news recently this week, buildings collapsing on each other while trapping little boys and girls beneath the rubble. Mass unmarked graves filled with the bodies of young and old. Starvation, changing virus variants, and more. The question for us is that when we open God's word, does it have something to say? Does God have something to say to this kind of broken world and this kind of broken reality that we live in? Filled with things that, if we're honest, we never get used to. Yes. Yes, God has something to say. He has something hopeful to say. In Romans chapter 8, verses 16 through 25, they introduce us to these two words here that we see, particularly in verse 25, wait and hope. Wait and hope. Which, brothers and sisters, are not words that are meant to push us into a kind of passivity where we put our hands in our pockets and we just look at our watches and wait for Jesus to make everything new without taking any action about these things. They're not words meant to stave us off until God can come up with some kind of solution that may or may not work. These words aren't meant to communicate a crossing of the fingers, hoping that maybe your suffering will end one day, maybe things will get better. These words come to us from the reality that something has already been done. The process for this hope, for God's hope of renewing and restoring and redeeming this world, has already started. It's already begun. It will come to pass. And we can be encouraged, for those of us who believe and entrust ourselves to the finished work of Jesus in our place for our sin. Everyone who God's Spirit lives and dwells within, we can have a confident assurance and an expectation that God is at work for our good, right now and continuously, eternally. So what we're looking at today in verses 16 through 25, we're just looking at one main point that we've been doing the last, almost as long as we've been in this series. One main point is this. If God is for us, then it means that he has given us hope. And this is really good news. If God is for us, it means that he has given us hope, an unshakable hope, a rock-solid hope that we can build our lives on in this world full of suffering. And we'll see that point fleshed out in two main things. What is this hope? What is our hope as followers of Jesus? And then what are the implications of this hope for us right now? So rather than just walking through these verses, verse by verse, we'll jump around and we'll put together a picture of what is or what the reality is that we're moving towards in this hope as followers of Jesus. You see that God's Spirit is present within us, right? We talked about that the last few weeks, that God has put his Spirit within us and that we could say that we are in God's Spirit. And he does this for a purpose. He doesn't just take us out of the world or snap his fingers and make us completely new and put us in heaven, but he's put his Spirit within us intentionally for a purpose, for something to happen, to move us towards something. He's leading us to something. And we see what that is. It's a hope that speaks to and envelops all of who we are. It's a comprehensive hope. Speaks to our minds, our bodies, and our spirits. And this hope is better than anything else we could ever imagine. So let's jump in. What is our hope? Last week we spent some time talking about the reality that because God is for us in Jesus, we saw that he is our Father. Happy Father's Day, brothers and sisters. He's adopted us and he's transformed us to be a part of his family. And from that legal and transformational reality, now we see God differently. That's not a product of behavior change, but a product of a deep transformational work at the core of who we are. We see God differently. He's no longer just judge, he is Father. We see God differently in the way that in that we interact with him, the way that parents and children lovingly interact with each other. That's our relation to him now. And Paul says, he describes it, that we cry out by the Spirit, Abba, Father, the natural cry of a child to a parent. And what that communicates to us, especially about God, is that he loves us. He is for us. He is deeply interested and invested in us. He hears us when we cry out in our battles and struggles with sin and suffering in this world. And so in addition to seeing God differently as God's children, we also see sin differently, our sin differently. We saw that our disposition to our sin isn't harmony with it, but hostility to it. We hate our sin because God hates sin. Because we're God's children and God has already canceled sin's power over us, canceled suffering's power over us. Because of what he's already done, you and I can do and we can act in putting our sin to death regularly, the continuous indwelling sin that's in us, that'll be a part of our lives until the day our bodies die. We can fight. We can kill sin that's already been canceled. And so we see God differently, but we also work to put sin to death, all from this new nature, this transformational reality that's taken place within us because of Jesus. So now in verse 16, we're looking at one more implication of what it means to be God's children. And we need these implications, right? We need to continuously be told that we are the children of God, that this is the reality over our lives, the fact, the legal reality. But also the loving reality that this is how God sees you right now, follower of Jesus. We need to keep hearing about the fact that we are God's children, because if we're honest and living in a world with sin's presence in us and around us, it's tough to make the distinction sometimes. We constantly are running into identity crises as the people of God. I mean, look, it's not like it's that distinguishable or distinguishable at all to others. The people around us, we don't look any different. We might sound different, might think or live differently, but visibly, how can we tell How can they tell? How can you tell that we are the children of God? So because of this, you and I, we're so prone to forgetting. Forgetting who we are, forgetting whose we are, and what it means of the fact that we are God's children. And so what it means to be God's children is having God's Spirit living within us to remind us and to speak the truth to us in these moments of our forgetfulness and our guilt and our doubt and all of the things that would seek to cause you to forget that you are God's child. It's a present reality, an identity, that the Spirit of God within us testifies and speaks the truth to our spirits that we are the children of God. That's what he's there for. That's why Jesus has lived and died, so that God's Spirit could live within you to remind you of this reality in this world. It's a present and unchanging reality, whether we feel like it or not. So listen, brothers and sisters, what is it that causes you to forget this? What are the things that you've run into this past week, or even the things that you will run into next week, things that you're bringing in here with you right now that are causing you to forget that you are a child of God? Not because of anything that you could or couldn't do, but solely because of Jesus, God's Son, and what he's done. What is it that causes you to forget? Is it a battle with sin that you feel like you will never win? Is it some sort of suffering or affliction? Is it the fact that things go so well for you in your life that you really don't think that you actually need God on some days? And you have to be brought back to that reality. What is it that causes you to forget this? In what moments do you lose sight of this truth? See, listen, if we've entrusted ourselves to Jesus, his person and his worth, then God's Spirit speaks to the deepest part of who you are. God's Spirit speaks to the deepest part of who you are to assure you for the rest of your life that you are his. You belong to him. That is the work of the Spirit, to point you to God, to point you to God's Son and God's plan and work of redemption. To point you away from trusting in all of the other hollow and false and shallow realities that we turn to for assurance regularly. God's Spirit testifies with our spirit that we are the children of God, and that means something. That should make a difference in our lives when it comes to how we live in this world, and even how we view and see this world that's plagued by sin. So ultimately, what does it mean that we are the children of God? Well, it means this. It means that we have a hope. We have an eternal and unshakable hope, a great hope. Look at verse 17. If children, then heirs. Heirs of God and co-heirs with Jesus. Heirs along with Jesus. Notice that word, with Jesus. What this means essentially is that you and I, we have a bright future in Jesus. We are the possessors of an inheritance that is ours right now. Not when our father dies, because he won't. He never will. And that is the beauty of the inheritance. Every time we see God and look at him, when we see the fact that he is never going away, our inheritance is sure. Our hope is sure and steadfast. It's not the promise of a life insurance company that you've been paying a premium on and then they go away. Our Father's never going away. But we become possessors of this inheritance, not when we die physically, but when we died to our former nature. When we experience this transformational reality within us that changed us from people who are living by their sin nature, by the flesh, to people who are living by the transformed nature of the Spirit, this inheritance is ours right now. We are heirs, not becoming, not one day will be if you keep your fingers crossed and you do everything right. You are heirs and co-heirs with Jesus. I was watching a show the other day, Kim's Convenience, and the guy was sitting in the in the office of his boss, and he was trying to figure out, he had just gotten his job back, and he was waiting to find out kind of where he was on the totem pole because another somebody had gotten a promotion. So he said, am I here? And the lady goes, well, you kind of, you know, she was trying to find her hand. So you kind of right here. And he goes, okay, so I'm about right here. And she drops her chair and goes, yeah, you right here. And so what it means that we are co-heirs is that we're right there. Even in a sibling relationship, Jesus is our brother. We are co-heirs. Now, you and I, we're not Jesus, obviously. But what he extends to us is the fellowship of God, an invitation to sit at this table of joy and fellowship and peace and life that exists within the Godhood eternally. 1 Peter calls it, 2 Peter, that you are partaker in the divine nature. I'm not even going to act like I can explain that. But the language is there. You get an invitation to share in the joy and the fellowship of God. And that makes you a co-heir. And that happens when we die to our former nature. So what is it that we inherit exactly? Well, right now and forever, we inherit an existence, a present and a future that is connected to the most powerful and supreme person in the universe. To summarize it, our inheritance is that we are with Christ. With Christ. Our inheritance is that our destiny, our future, even our present right now is tied to His, directly to Him. So much so that we are siblings, right? And what we will become is intertwined with who He is and who He will be. The most highly exalted, the one who's given a name above every name in the universe that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. He's raised us up, Paul says in Ephesians, to be seated in heavenly places with Him. Jesus shares in the very life of God as God, and He extends this life to all who trust in Him, and that is our inheritance. A word for that? Glory. Glorified. Our inheritance is with Him. We're co-heirs with Him. And we will be glorified, jump down, with Him. So our inheritance is ultimately, and I skipped one thing there, but also if we suffer with Him. But our inheritance is ultimately that we will be glorified with Him. And let's explain that first. What does it mean that we will be glorified with Him? That word glorified, it communicates a lot of things. Things that I don't have time to fully unpack and could probably never unpack. But it means a lot of things. It means perfected. It means honored. It means, again, having a share in the divine. But here specifically, an implication of what being glorified means, of experiencing that glory that comes along with Jesus, it means being transfigured in our bodies, being transformed and changed in our bodies. That's what Paul's been talking about all throughout this passage in Romans chapter 8, right? Our bodies. And even Romans chapter 7, he says, he talks about this body of death that he lives in chapter 7, verse 24. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 12, he talks about the flesh or the body of sin. He goes on to talk about killing sin in our bodies. And he talks about how the presence of God's Spirit in us means that, like Jesus, our dying bodies, our dying physical bodies, will be resurrected after death to be immortal like Jesus. Right? If the same Spirit that lives in Jesus, that raised Jesus from the dead, lives in you, then that same Spirit will resurrect your body. And it will be just like Jesus's. Immortal. So part of being glorified is what verse 23 says, if you jump down, it says it's the redemption of our bodies. The redemption of our bodies, which is the full manifestation or the full revealing, the pulling the curtain off of the truth that we have been adopted into God's family. He doesn't just adopt you in some large sense that doesn't really have any real transformational effect over your life, where you are brought into His family and you stay the same. Something is happening within us even right now that will one day show that we are the children of God in fullness. And that implication is that our bodies will be made new. They will be renewed. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul talks about how the perishable, these perishable, decaying bodies will be clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal will put on immortality. 1 Peter talks about how the inheritance that we have in Jesus, it is imperishable and undefiled and unfading. That's the quality of body that we will experience and live in with God forever. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 talks about how although our bodies are dying and decaying every single day, who can attest to this, right? All of us. Something is at work. The process has already begun. And unlike my 76ers, it will not fail. Our spirits are being renewed every single day. This is what you have to look forward to, brothers and sisters. This process taking effect, working in your life, even when you don't feel it, even when you can't see it, you don't even know what's going on right now, and it's still happening. That's God's promise. That's God's guarantee. That's God's power. He does what we cannot do, and that's transform our bodies. This is what you have to look forward to. And again, this has already begun right now. And so we said this last week, but we saw and we see that because Paul has been mentioning the body and how it matters what we do in our bodies, that the body is really important to God. We don't get saved and then just focus on what's going on inside of us and just sort of disregard the flesh and the thing, this body that God has put us in. This is a part of who we are. God cares about it. It's not just going to collapse one day and fall into the earth and just sort of go away. He's going to resurrect this body, your body, to stand before him, and he's going to renew it and redeem it for all of those who have placed their faith and trust in Jesus. God cares about our bodies, and Jesus is the greatest evidence of the fact that God cares about human bodies. One, he makes us in his image. We talked about that last week, how every person in this world is an image bearer, and that means something because God has put them and created them in a body. No matter what they wrestle with or struggle with, they are image bearers, and they deserve honor and dignity and worth, all of us. But God cares even more particularly and intentionally for those who are his children, who've placed their hope and faith in the person and work of Jesus. And he makes a promise to our bodies that he will restore them and redeem them and renew them, that they will live forever. So God cares about our bodies, and Jesus is the greatest evidence of that because God sends Jesus not to live as a hologram or some kind of sort of person body or some visual appearance that's heresy. He sends Jesus to live in an actual human body, just like ours, that experiences all the fatigue and the stress and the frustration that's tempted to sin like ours, although he is sinless. It matters that God sent his son in a body in this world. He sends his son to live perfectly in a human body for the ways that we live imperfectly in our human bodies. And then he sends his son to die sacrificially in a human body to bear the punishment that we deserve on our human bodies. Death. But then, right, God raises that human body of Jesus's, fully God and fully man. That body that was beaten, that body that suffered greatly, that body that died. He brings that body back to life. Think about how intentional God is in doing this. Jesus' body doesn't sit in the grave and then he shows up to hundreds of people later in some other body. No, he takes that body that was in the tomb and he rolls the stone back and he transforms that body to a new body. So what we see here and what this means and the fact that God cares about our bodies because he cares about Jesus' body is that Jesus is the blueprint of our renewal. Do you want to know what your future looks like? Look at Jesus. Look at the resurrection. Dig deep within that teaching and what we see about it. Read 1 Corinthians 15. We will see exactly what this looks like. You will be resurrected to live, even in a realer way than you are living and existing right now. Our senses are dull, shallow. We're good with a game and some really shallow kinds of sins and pleasures and all kinds of weak things. But in these renewed bodies that we will get, that will be resurrected, we will have full senses to be able to calculate and perceive and take in the fullness of joy and peace and life and satisfaction that are in God forever, endlessly. Again, that's tough for us to wrap our minds around because we don't know anything else than what we know right now. But this is our hope. So, brothers and sisters, do you want to know what will happen to your body? The body that you are in right now, with whatever condition that is in, if it's failing you, frustrating you, if it's laden with weakness or sickness, or even if it's been burdened down with the implications of sin, like abuse or trauma, or even if your body has been downtrodden because of its appearance, God has something to say to you. If we are in him, if we are with him, then the destiny of our bodies is directly connected to Jesus's, because our inheritance is with him. And Jesus will renew and transform our broken and fleeting bodies to be just like his. Glorified, no sin, no suffering, no weakness, no pain. All of the realities that we learn to live with and cope with, but never feel normal, will be wiped away. This is not how God intended for his creation to experience life. Don't get used to it. Don't fall into apathy or despair or hopelessness because of the things going on in your body or that happened to your body. Look and see that God promises us through Jesus a greater hope. Glorification. Let's move on to the next implication, but to get there with Jesus. Another implication of being God's children and his heirs is that we must walk on the road of suffering. Look ahead, see that hope of glorification, but also look in front of you. Because the way to that is through the road of suffering. It doesn't mean things are just going to get tremendously worse for you. You are and have been suffering in this world. Everybody suffers. I don't care how much you have or haven't been through, or what you think you have and haven't been through. We must walk the road of suffering. But notice that it doesn't just say that, but it says this, with him. And again, suffering refers to the broken experiences in this fallen world that's impacted by sin in every single area, that affects us in every single area, mental, physical, and spiritual. Everybody suffers, Christian or not. Everyone in this world has suffered or will suffer. So listen, I know oftentimes as Christians, we can read this to just believe and to think that this is just suffering for the name of Jesus. Like maybe you go to another country or you go down the street to work and someone mocks you for being a Christian or someone even kills you for being a Christian. It includes that certainly. But this includes all kind of suffering. Because it's not just focus on if or that we suffer. Again, we all suffer. But it's the reality of our experiencing suffering with him. That's the focus. We will suffer with him. It's a part of our inheritance. As people, we all suffer, but not everybody gets to suffer with him. And that makes all the difference. To be a Christian means suffering with Jesus. Everyone suffers, but what makes the suffering of the children of God different from others isn't anything that has to do with what's in us or what's within the suffering. It's who is with us in our suffering. Do you get that? It's who is with you in your suffering. It's the disposition of your entire life that comes from your being transformed, that changes, that helps you to see as a follower of Jesus, that somebody is with you in your suffering, and that makes all the difference. When your body won't function like it should, do you suffer with him? When you're putting sin to death that you have battled for years and it feels like you keep losing and you'll never win, do you suffer with him? When you encounter natural disasters or diseases or major life interruptions, are you suffering with him? When financial hardship or depression or disease or family problems or infertility or job loss or pandemics or loneliness come into your life, whatever you're suffering, do you turn to Jesus? Do you see that he is with you in your suffering? With you in this boat of this storm happening around you? Do you see that? Or do you turn somewhere else? Do you look to your careers or your relationships? Do you look to the things that can promise you happiness or things that can promise you the evading or the release of your suffering or the fixing of yourself? Who do you turn to in your suffering? Because the children of God, they have a different perspective. Something in them helps them to see life differently. Abba, Father, someone is for me and with me in suffering. It's a disposition of your heart, one that says, Jesus, be near me. Be with me. Or do we turn somewhere else? Again, this is different, brothers and sisters, than calling you to do something in your suffering. Giving you all the cliches. Just hang in there. Be strong. Do it. Lift your head up. All the stuff, right? You hear it. I hear it. As well-intentioned as it is, this isn't calling you to do something. Because if you've ever suffered immensely, you know that there ain't nothing you can do in the midst of suffering. You are there. You exist. It doesn't seem like there's hope on the horizon. Being a Christian means it's not about what you can do in your suffering, but what God commits himself to do for you and in you in the midst of your suffering. If you jump back to verse 16, it's this: God's Spirit testifies to your spirit that you are the children of God. He's for you. He's there in you and with you in the midst of unspeakable realities that you and I cannot bear and deal with. He does what you cannot do. He speaks the truth to you in a way that takes effect like the words of nobody else. He says things to us. He speaks the truth to our spirit that we are God's children. That in your suffering, brothers and sisters, God hasn't abandoned you or left you to yourself. That even in your suffering, it's not punishment or proof that you were never his. The Spirit testifies to us that our sufferings with Jesus are the pathway to being glorified with Jesus. That's the Spirit's promise to us. That's what it means that God is for us. Even as we continue to live and exist in this world that's filled with all kinds of suffering. So listen, brothers and sisters. Again, suffering is really hard and it's really, really heavy. And I know verse 18 so often gets quoted a lot in the midst of suffering, if you've ever heard it, but Paul is not making light of suffering here. So before I get here and unpack this a little bit, please know that. This is not cliche. Again, some of you have experienced suffering that many of us couldn't fathom or begin to understand. Things that have shaped us to our very core and changed us for the rest of our lives. And there's no cliche that can make it better. So verse 18 isn't a whimsical distraction. It's not meant to just kind of point your eyes somewhere else other than the pain. So don't hear verse 18 in that way. Hear these words from a man who experienced tremendous suffering, a human who experienced tremendous suffering in his own body at the hands of others, but also within himself. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians how he suffered beatings and disasters and injustices and death threats and anxiety and hunger and thirst, being shipwrecked. All kinds of things. Mental suffering, physical suffering, spiritual suffering. These are his words. If anybody's telling and talking to anyone, he's talking to himself. And Paul hasn't looked away as for a distraction to take his eyes off of the pain and the things that he's endured and having to endure presently, even as he writes this in a jail. No, he's looking suffering in the face. He's looking pain in the face, not strong, but weak as anyone could ever be. And at the same time, he also sees the very real hope in the person and work of Jesus. He sees both of these things at the same time. And that's what he means when he says, "For I consider, I thought about this. I've given thought to it in the midst of my suffering when I thought God has abandoned me or things will never be any different or my body won't be any different. I consider, I think about, I take note, I remind myself, I encourage myself. The Spirit speaks to me and testifies within me the reality, this truth, that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is going to be revealed to us." He's speaking from experience, and he's speaking about what suffering with Jesus looks like. Our vision isn't just focused and limited to the suffering that is right in front of us. Our vision has been expanded as the children of God. We see God for who he is, his goodness, his grace, his loving, fatherly care for us and adopting us. And we hear his promises that he is committed to transforming us and changing us forever. And that picture, man, it is so beautiful that it makes the suffering that we are presently going through, as painful as it is, it doesn't minimize it. It doesn't soften its blow all the time necessarily. But it gives us hope, unchanging, steadfast, and solid. Solid assurance that God is for us and with us. So this is what Paul is speaking about when he's talking about suffering with Jesus. An incomparable revelation of glory. A new creation, a new body without the presence of sin and suffering. The fullness of joy and satisfaction and life and peace that comes from seeing and knowing God. This is our hope, brothers and sisters. And without Jesus and without the Spirit, verse 18 is just a cliche. It's just a crossing of your fingers that things hopefully will get better for you. This is what makes the inheritance of suffering with Jesus better than suffering alone with no hope. So real quick before we move on and finish this up, let's back up to verse 16, because that's where the original idea and the flow of thought starts with here, and what Paul is getting to. He says, "The Spirit testifies that we are God's children," and we've explained some implications of what that means, right? We'll suffer and we'll be glorified, and it's all while being in union with Jesus. But another reason why it's so important for us to know and to be assured that we're God's children is because in the same way that Jesus is the blueprint of our renewal, what's happening in us by God's Spirit is the blueprint for the renewal of the entire creation. This is more than just about what's taking place in our lives. What is taking place in us transformatively, powerfully, is one day going to eclipse everything that you see and know in all creation. Creation, Paul says, is waiting for transformation. Look at verse 20. It explains how at the disobedience of our first parents, we see that sin entered into the world, and it didn't just affect Adam and Eve and their human offspring like us in solely bringing death and separation from God. Their decision, their sin affected everything else, all of creation. Genesis 3, part of what God tells Adam after he's sinned is that the ground, the earth, nature, creation is cursed because of you. Sin has significant implications. people die, and everything dies. Understand this, because this shapes how we view the world. This shapes how we, as followers of Jesus, see and have an explanation for why this world is the way that it is, and why we don't have to be hopeless in it, or just accept this reality that we know isn't the norm. Everybody knows that. The curse of the fall has biological, geological, agricultural, astrological, and zoological impact. I wish I could unpack that more, but sin has touched everything. Sin has touched everything. From your dog and cat, to the deepest parts of who you are, to the reason why you turn on the news and your social media news feeds, and brokenness and sin and suffering pervade this world every single day. Sin has broken everything in this world. So listen, this is why, as followers of Jesus, whenever we open our news feeds or turn on the news or encounter the people that God has strategically put us around and we hear their stories of sin and suffering and brokenness, we should all mourn. We should be the people who mourn the most, because we know sin. We have a realization about sin and what it can do and its power and what it can potentially do to all creation that should cause deep brokenness in us and humility. We should mourn sin as we see it in this world and in other people, but not just that. We should mourn our own sin, because although our personal sin might not directly cause the broken realities that we see in this world, like earthquakes and hurricanes and diseases and pandemics, in this one-to-one relation, it's that same presence of sin, capital S, that seeks to destroy our bodies in addition to the body of creation. It's that same capital S sin that is responsible for all the destruction in the world. The very sin that causes you to lash out in anger or pursue lust is the same sin that has pervaded this entire created order and causes the brokenness that we see around us every single day. Brothers and sisters, this is why we should mourn when buildings collapse on residents, and mourn when tsunamis and storms and famines and volcanoes and diseases ravage this planet, because they show us a picture and a glimpse of how devastating, how awful sin is. And they show us that it's not just us. It's not just you and the deepest part of yourself and your life and your actions, but it's everything in this world. That groaning that you experience, that longing for more, that frustration and with that weakness of being unable to do anything about you and our sin nature, creation shares in that groaning. All of creation shares in that groaning. Creation has been subjected to futility and chaos, and it's experiencing the bondage to decay. And Paul says it's groaning with labor pains together until now. But even it knows that there's a blueprint. There's a blueprint. Creation lives in this Advent season, this longing and anticipation for something else to happen. It is waiting for something in the same way that you and I, as the children of God, are waiting and hoping for something. God subjected the creation into this state of chaos and sin and futility, not without reason, but for the purpose, for a purpose that is filled with hope. That one day things won't always be like they are. You and I won't always be like we are as the children of God. God will redeem. God will restore. Creation and us will be set free from the bondage of sin's power of death and decay. And in you and I, that process has already started. That's already taken place because of Jesus coming into this world to live perfectly where we've lived imperfectly, to die sacrificially when we couldn't bear the punishment and the penalty for our sins, and to be resurrected powerfully, giving us acceptance and forgiveness and joy and life with God forever. That's already started in you, and it is taking place in this world around you. Creation is looking at you every morning that you get up and you drive your car or you go to school. Wherever you are, creation is looking at you, child of God, saying, I want what they've got. Give me what's going on in them. And hopefully this encourages us to keep fighting sin, to keep battling, to keep working, to be fueled and aligned with the person and work of who God is and who he's revealed himself to be in his son, Jesus. Because you and I are not without hope. And creation looks and sees that it is not without hope. And it is waiting for the first fruits of the children of God. Again, there's no visible difference right now in you, in me, and anybody else in this world, of who we are. God will one day make that known. But we are being renewed inwardly right now. And then we will be resurrected and renewed eternally after we die. And then creation will follow us in that renewal. It's like that little meme, right? Look at us, right? We're going to be looking at creation and going, look at us now, right? Everything will be transformed and changed. But right now, creation groans. And we groan while we wait, but we don't groan hopeless. We suffer, we lose, we feel, we mourn. Our bodies decay. They are decaying. And again, although we know what this great hope is, our waiting isn't passive. Again, we are actively putting sin to death in our bodies as a picture of what God will do and what God has already done by putting sin to death in his son. And we delight in God's will and God's law because that is the order that is coming. It's practice right now. It's aligning ourselves in our suffering and in our sin with who God is. Because one day that will pervade the entire created order. God will and has shown his commitment to renew and transform all things and set them free from bondage. And it's in this hope that we were saved. It's in this hope that we're saved, brothers and sisters. And so right now we wait and we hope patiently, not passively, but we are active in living in this world knowing that nothing can take us out. Death does not have the final word over us or creation. We have an eternal and steadfast hope because we have a Father who isn't going anywhere. And that process has already begun in you right now, and it will continue to happen. Let me pray for us.